Okay, so I was asked to talk about nucleosynthesis yields from compact object mergers from all possible sources. And I think you've heard some about this already, but I'll briefly review some things you've heard and maybe make a couple remarks you haven't heard already. So first, I'll just say a few general things. I'll talk about nuclei produced from the ejection of tidal tails, which you've heard many times now is our process. I'll talk about nuclei produced from accretion disk winds, and then I'll just make a series of remarks after that. Okay, so we have two types of environments. One is the tidal tails and one is the wind. And you get three types of nucleosynthesis that you could imagine coming from these environments. One is, of course, the R process. One is the P process. And the other is nickel and iron group nuclei. Okay, so here's a picture from Stefan Roswag. This is it's supposed to show the tidal tail. Some material gets unbound. This is a picture that shows a top-bound view of a disk in neutrinos. And these are the temperatures of the neutrinos, of the electron neutrinos and the anti-electron neutrinos. And when you're thinking about ejection from a disk, what I'm generally thinking of is material coming out of the plane at you toward the audience, usually ejected from the region where the neutrinos are trapped here. Okay, so there's a couple of important questions to ask. One is how much stuff gets ejected. So if you eject material and you start off in nucleons and you let it adiabatically expand, or it's hot and you let it cool, it will make nuclei. So you will make some nuclei for sure. The question is, what kind of nuclei do you make? And so you want to know how much there are and what kind of nuclei you have. Okay, so I have to refer to a number of authors, of which I only have a few here, that estimate how much material you should get. From winds, estimates are around 10 to the minus 3, 10 to the minus 4 solar masses. From tidal tail ejections, estimates are 10 to the minus 3 to 10 to the minus 2 solar masses about. And Brian Metzger also discusses thermonuclear winds, which have similar ranges. Okay, so these two environments are really, they're fairly different. So if you think of a hot wind, you think of material that's starting, it's maybe at the surface of a neutrino trapped region, which is pretty hot. So it starts at several MeV or so. And what happens to that material after it leaves the surface of that trapped region is fairly important, because all of the weak rates are important. The electron, the positron rates and the electron rates are important. There's a sea of positrons, a sea of electrons. And you also have enormous numbers of neutrinos coming out, electron neutrinos and electron antineutrinos. And these can all capture back and forth on the neutrons and protons, and they can change the relative numbers of neutrons and protons, which of course changes the final nuclei that you expect to get out. If you want the R process, you need something with many neutrons. If you want something lighter, then you need something with more protons. And generally, there's some heating that's going on here, so you're not really looking at entropy per baryon and units of Boltzmann constant of anything less than 20 or so. If you have tidal tails, it's really quite different. Typically, when people do nucleosynthesis calculations, they don't even start until about 10 to the 10 Kelvin or so, because there is not a lot that you have to follow with the weak rates that's going on. You just keep the neutron richness of the material that you have already. And then at some point, when the nuclei start doing things for combining together to make other nuclei, then you have to worry about all the nuclear reactions. So these weak rates are not so essential. Of course, there's an important weak rate in the R process, which is beta decay, but you're not making big changes in the neutron to proton ratio through the weak rates. Generally, you assume that you're very far away from sources of neutrinos and antineutrinos, and you're so neutron rich that you're polyblocked, so you can't have a lot of positron and electron capture. So you look at this kind of thing happens typically, what we've heard about is that in tidal ejection. Okay, so let's talk about, just briefly go over what's going on in the R process. As you know, you need a lot of neutrons if you want to make very neutron-rich nuclei. And how do you do that? Well, all the simulations get reasonably hot, hot enough so that you come into some sort of equilibrium between neutron capture and photo dissociation. Okay. So, and you're not in equilibrium with beta decay, so along an isotopic chain here, the distribution of elements is determined by the separation energies, not by the individual neutron capture rates. But the beta, then the nuclei can beta decay out of these various nuclei, make a new element, and then get redistributed along an isotopic chain. So that's basically what's going on in the R process. And you tend to have N gamma gamma N equilibrium above temperatures about 10 to the 9 Kelvin or so. Now that doesn't happen in all proposed R process environments. You can have proposed R process environments where you just neutron capture and you barely ever photodissociate. But mostly what we're talking about here is environments where you spend a lot of time in this stage. Okay, so here's a picture that is tidal tail ejection. And the point here that was made in this paper is that no matter what you do, you always get the same pattern. So the dots are the data, and the curves are many different models that produce this pattern. So this is abundance over here, and this is mass number over here. Okay, so why does it look like that? Why do you always get exactly the same thing? Well, what they argue is that it's because of fission cycling. So why does fission cycling make a difference? Here's a little plot where you look at the mass. So I should have pointed out the two peaks in the previous slide. Here, this is called the third peak, this is called the rare earth bump, and this is called the second peak. Okay. So if you look at the amount of stuff in this peak and you compare it to the amount of stuff in that peak, that gives you some measure of, and you look at many simulations, that gives you some measure of how consistent your pattern is. And this is a plot that's not of any particular model of supernovae or neutron star merger. It's just a bunch of nucleosynthesis calculations where you arbitrarily go in and you stick your hand in the calculation and you just dial the number of neutrons and protons. And so every point represents a different calculation. And this is the neutron richness of the material on this axis. So this is most neutron rich here, and this is not neutron rich at all, and this is the ratio. Okay. And you can see in the beginning, you don't get any R process material. The ratio is very small. But as you start moving, you start doing calculations where you're more and more neutron rich, you wind up with a big lump at the last peak. But when you get after that, the nucleus can break into two, and those daughter products show up somewhere. And some of them show up at or below the third peak. And so then then the big lump moves down to the second peak. Then the lump moves forward again, and then you're at the third peak and on. But eventually you've gone through this cycle so many times that you come into a sort of equilibrium, and no longer matters how neutron rich you make the material, you get the same thing over and over again. And this is what was happening in that previous calculation. The YE was so low that small changes in the electron fraction, which would have made a big difference if you had a higher electron fraction, really basically make no difference at all. Okay, so in that kind of calculation, we're not so worried about the neutrinos because we're far away from the neutrinos. But if we eject material that's closer to the point where the neutrinos are trapped, then we have to care about all of these reactions. Okay? And typically, what happens is that the electrons and the positrons are, so they're, when the neutrinos are trapped, everything is in equilibrium. But as you look above the surface of the star, the temperature declines, and the electrons and positrons are in equilibrium, so their temperature is declining. But the neutrinos don't have their temperature declining anymore because they're decoupled. Their flux is declining, but their temperature is not. And so for a little while, the neutrinos win. And so the more important reactions are the ones that are going to the right, neutrino capture on neutron and antineutrino capture on proton. So here's an example of a simple calculation, which we did. This is a picture to give you a sense of scales. This is sort of disk radius over here. This is supposed to indicate the trapped regions for the neutrinos. And this is height above the disk here. Okay, and this, so these are the trapped regions, and this little dashed line is supposed to represent a rough path the material might take. And you can see that these reactions are very strong until you get to the point where the YE is set. Then the neutron to proton ratio tends not to evolve anymore, but that happens quite a bit before the neutrons and protons, we say recombine, but we really mean combine into alpha particles, which then combine into seed nuclei. And if you're lucky enough to get in our process, you've actually gotten pretty far away by the time that's happening. Okay. So you do some calculations, and there's some uncertainty. But what's happening in this type of setup is that the antineutrinos are winning. And so you make things neutron rich, and by the time you get here, you have neutrons left over. And depending on the parameters, you either get a whole R process or you get part of an R process. Okay. This really isn't perfect. This is our calculation, and notice we have kind of a hole here. Okay, there's another reason this calculation isn't really perfect. And that is because it's really complicated to calculate the neutrinos. So the way the calculation was done is, even though on this picture I showed a sort of a 2D neutrino surface, when the calculation was done, the emission of the neutrinos was assumed to come from flat planes on the disk. And on top of that, even though you're emitting relatively close to the black hole, all the neutrinos took straight line trajectories. Okay. All right, so effectively we assumed some kind of flat picture like that for the neutrinos to be emitted from, but really the neutrinos should be emitted from this. Okay, so this is a color code, so red is the hottest temperature and blue is the coolest temperature, and it's kind of an unfriendly looking surface. And on top of that, the neutrinos shouldn't really be traveling straight. They should be bending and they should be getting redshifted. All right, so we try to take that into account by letting the neutrinos get emitted from somehow from a complicated surface, and also including the trajectory bending and the redshift of the neutrinos. So we did the same calculation as before, but we just made those two modifications. And what happened is, instead of the beautiful pattern, we got this. Okay? So in this calculation, the R process went away, and we wound up with lots of iron group nuclei. Particularly, you can't really tell, but we have a lot of nickel 56. Okay. So what's happening is that the hottest neutrinos are the antineutrinos, and they're emitted closest to the black hole. So they are more influenced by redshifting and trajectory bending than the neutrinos, which were emitted from a more diffuse surface. Okay, and on top of that, the structure of this disk, it somehow goes down and comes up, and the hotter things are emitted from the center, which are the antineutrinos, so they tend to lose their influence. So even though you don't see dramatic changes in the overall rates of the neutrinos, it's really a very subtle effect. It's the balance of the neutrino capture and then the antineutrino capture that makes the material either neutron or proton rich. And when all these effects were included, we found that we actually made material that was slightly proton rich. Oddly. Okay, so that's not to say you can't recover the R process at all. That was in a calculation that had a fair amount of heating. But if you let your entropy be kind of low and your outflow be very, very fast, then you can avoid the effects of the neutrino, maintain some of the neutron richness of the disk, and you recover from the R process again. So it's not out of the question that you get the R process from this type of configuration, but only if you somehow move more in the direction of the type of conditions that you would have in tidal tails, things where you don't have, a lot of as much heating and you don't have as much influence of the neutrinos. Again, notice the hole. Okay, so in this situation, you'd expect to get something that you get more similar to collapsar type disks, where you get enormous numbers of nickel 56. So you get, depending on the entropy and the outflow time scale, 10, 20, 30, 40, 50, 60% of your ejecta is coming out as nickel 56. This is as a function of accretion rate down here. You can also get P process. You might expect to get P process elements this way. Light P process elements are a little bit hard to produce. Now it's thought that some of them come from supernovae, but you could also, if you have slightly proton-rich ejecta and you have a large flux of neutrinos, the actual balance is not so important for the neutrino capture on the protons that then creates neutrons at late stages and makes p-process elements. So you might expect to be very effective at producing p-process elements. So here's a calculation from a disk, probably a slightly more slowly accreting disk than you might typically find in a binary merger, but the dots, the open dots, are the calculation without the neutrinos, and the solid dots are the calculation with the neutrino. So it's late time capture on protons that make neutrons that makes these very hard to make nuclei in the light P process. And you can see over here that for a range of outflow parameterizations and for a range of entropies, you can get really large overproduction factors of these type of nuclei. Okay, so what are the implications of the nucleosynthesis from compact object mergers? So it looks very likely that you get R process from the tidal tails, maybe quite a bit of R process. Maybe you can get some from neutrino winds that come off the surface, but it's also a significant possibility, and that's what it looks like. More things have to be included, but that's what it looks like now. So you're getting a lot of nickel, other iron group nuclei, and probably some rare elements like the P process this way. Okay, so I put in a slide because I was really interested. It's nice to come to a meeting where people are so enthusiastic about producing R-process nuclei. The nucleosynthesis community tends to be a little gloomy about this particular problem and see kind of the problems that you have in trying to find R-process nuclei. But the predictions here are very enthusiastic and large, which I think is really, it's wonderful. It's very optimistic. So I just put in this slide. I noticed that if you look at the suggested numbers and you compare to the galactic amount of the R-process nuclei, you can make it all, okay? You can make potentially all of the R-process nuclei with these numbers. So numbers I see quoted are things like 10 to the minus 1 solar masses to 10 to the minus 3 solar masses. And if you put that together with, say, a galactic merger rate of 10 to the minus 4 per year, and over 10 of the 10 years, you'll get between 10 to the 5 and 10 to the 3 solar masses of material. So the amount of R-process solar system stuff, that should be the amount of galactic mass you have for R-process nuclei with A greater than 100, that's not really counting the first peak, only the second and third peaks, is around to the 10 to the 4. So with these kind of numbers, I mean, it certainly depends on what your merger rate is, you can make all the R-process. So that's great to make all of the R-process material. So why is the nucleosynthesis community somewhat more gloomy? And I think they want to solve a whole lot of problems at the same time, okay? So R-process material is not only seen in the solar system, it's also seen in very old stars, okay? So you want to somehow get the material that you see, that you make, if you want a single process to make all of the R process, you want to be able to have your process eject material and get it into the old halo stars in a reasonable amount of time, okay? And so that means that the neutron star mergers have to evolve a little more quickly than naive estimates make. And in addition, the ejecta has to become very well mixed in the ISM, more so than it is predicted. So if you solve the first problem and you make them evolve very quickly, then you tend to have each merger makes a lot of stuff, okay? And then if you look at the halo star, then you would find too much stuff unless you find a way to spread it around, okay? But that's not really a, that's only really a problem for mergers making the R process if you want to make all of the R process material from a merger. If you have another main source for the R process, it's not really an issue. You can make all the R process you want in mergers as long as you don't try to make everything this way. Okay. The other thing is there's gigantic uncertainties on the fission fragment distribution. These nuclei are very far